We are going to finish our discussions of mutual funds with some odds and ends. We'll discuss some fund families and some other characteristics of buying and selling funds. And then we'll take a look at a single mutual fund and see how these investments can help us over the long term. Slide number 61. Fund families. A family of funds exists when one investment company manages a group of mutual funds. Funds in the family vary in their objectives. It used to be that mutual fund companies would have one or two mutual funds, and then somebody would come along and create a large cap domestic growth and income fund, and they all had to do it, and so these funds have just, fund families have just exploded with dozens or some of them hundreds of offerings. You can move your money from one fund to another within a fund family almost always with no charge. Sometimes if you don't keep the money in a single fund for a certain amount of time and try to play, I'm going to move it around every month, they might hit you with a charge, or some of them will just stop you from doing it. They'll just say, you can't do this. But you have to be careful. If the fund is in a taxable account, you're going to generate a taxable transaction. The IRS is going to say, we don't care that it's in the same fund family. You sold this fund and bought this fund. You need to declare that as a capital gain or maybe a capital loss. Exactly. If it's in a retirement account, a tax-qualified account, that doesn't matter. And as we said, some companies are charging fees for excessive transfers or just not allowing it or maybe giving you 10 transfers a year or something like that. This was done to discourage market timing and also to discourage people from doing the kind of hanky-panky that we talked about way back in our first presentation, where people were doing things that weren't technically illegal, but certainly unethical. Mutual funds are long-term investments, not something used for trading. If you want to do that, go out and buy exchange-traded funds. Then the mutual fund company doesn't care. Although, I gotta believe, I must believe that folks like Vanguard and Fidelity, when they waive the brokerage fee for their ETFs, they probably don't have in mind you buying and selling them throughout the day as trading vehicles. Yeah, I haven't asked them, but I can almost imagine that they're going to say, sure, you know, you can buy our mutual funds once a month, as many people do, or, you know, buy them every once in a while, but move them around every once in a while, but not all the time. And Forbes said this a long time ago, and I like this. I wish I had said it. Choose a family, not a fund. And here they are, folks. Now, I need to get some more data. It's hard to find this stuff, and of course, I told you, the ICI wants to charge for it. What are the top mutual fund families? Well, this goes back a couple of years, and so it's I'm not sure. And you go to this website, they haven't changed it, so I don't know what's going on here. But here are the top families. Vanguard, we discussed them already. You can't help but hear about them. They do quite a bit of advertising. So does Fidelity. And as we said, Fidelity was the world's largest mutual fund company for many years, only to be toppled by Vanguard and their indexing. Fidelity has over 400 funds. Vanguard has about 170 or something like that. And then the third one is one that very few people have actually heard of. It's called American Funds. Well, that's not really their name. Their name is Capital Research and Management, or just sometimes referred to as the Capital Group. They do no advertising. They are only available through brokers. They're very old-fashioned and fuddy-duddy, some people call them. They have no index funds, and they don't think that's the best way to invest. Interesting. And in the face-to-face class, we would go through these three fund families. We would first look at Fidelity, and why is that? Because they have just too many. They have so hundreds of funds. And then Vanguard, we look at Vanguard, and they have about 160 or so. And then American has about 30-some, 38 or something like that. So we show how Fidelity, where they just have this shotgun approach, and then Vanguard, which has a lot, somewhat akin to other mutual fund companies, and then a company like American, which only has, you know, less than 40. And then if we have time, I show them Dodge & Cox, one of my favorite companies, but they only have 5 in this day and age. They've been around since 1930, 31, but they only have 5 mutual funds, you know. So there's this huge spectrum of opinion with regard to how they should run these mutual fund companies, obviously. PIMCO has the distinction, Pacific Investment Company, based in Newport Beach, I think. Oh, by the way, Vanguard's based outside of Philadelphia in King of Prussia, Malvern area. Fidelity's based in Boston. American's actually based in Los Angeles, although they're an interesting company. They inhabit one of the largest downtown skyscrapers in Los Angeles, in downtown L.A., but they have no name on the building. Their name is not on the building. This is how shy they are. Or I don't know if the word is shy. They just don't want to push themselves out there in the world. They want the brokers to do it for them. And figuring that they have no name on the building, it's one of the most photographed and used buildings by Hollywood, because it doesn't have, you know, GE or whatever, some IBM or some big name on the front of the building. So the folks in Hollywood film industry loves that building because they don't have to worry about advertising for somebody. PIMCO, as we said, PIMCO's in Newport Beach, but you know, these companies are global these days, and they have the distinction of having the world's largest mutual fund. It's a bond fund called the Total Return Fund. And we'll discuss bonds in detail later on, but there's a reason why it's called the Total Return Fund. Very, very famous fund. Very smart person who runs it. His name is Bill Gross. Outspoken, indeed. J.P. Morgan, you've heard of them, right? Yeah, they bought a whole bunch of mutual fund companies, and they now are the fifth largest. The sixth largest is Franklin Templeton, and we'll discuss Mr. Templeton, Sir John Templeton, later on. Very good group, Franklin Templeton and Mutual Shares, based in, again, they're based in Los Angeles. Now, BlackRock, oh boy, are these guys smart. These guys are smart. Why? They got the contract with the federal government to run the Thrift Savings Program. Yeah, and that's part of your assignment, is to go research the Thrift Savings Program. And then Federated. You know, I haven't looked at their funds in a long time, so I really shouldn't say nasty things about anybody, but I feel sorry for people at Federated. You read the reports, and the guy's always going, or gal's going, yeah, we're going to do better next time, you know, we're ready to work. Well, you just wait and see. And then T. Rowe Price, a very good company that deserves your attention. Take a good look at T. Rowe Price, based in Baltimore. Been around for a long time, and another very good fund family. And then Dreyfus Corporation, an old mutual fund company that made its mark in the 50s and 60s, 1960s, they were really big. And then the Bank of New York bought them. The Bank of New York is the oldest bank in the United States. You don't hear too much about it. Many people call it the Banker's Bank, but that's not true. That's actually the Federal Reserve Bank. But if you remember the bailout of the banks back in 2008 and 2009, guess who handled the money for the other banks, right? The Bank of New York. Interesting. And if anybody can come up with more recent data without having to pay $600 a year, please contact me, okay? Because I'm going to update this. It's a couple years old, needs to be updated. Slide number 63. As I said, in the face-to-face class, we would show these on the screen and go through them, not everything, but we'll try to show you the sip from the fire hose, how many darn funds there are. On the website, on the class website, are links to these, not all of these companies, but Vanguard, Fidelity, American, T. Rowe Price, I think I have Franklin Templeton, I think I have I do have Dodge and Cox. Good company. Take a look at Dodge and Cox. And I want you to just see how many thousands of funds are out there. Just unbelievable. One of the really, Fidelity is a sharp company, folks. They not only sell their own mutual funds, they sell other companies' mutual funds. And, of course, if you're a company, a small company, trying to break out into the industry and make yourself known, you'd be happy to have Fidelity because they're so big. You'd be happy to piggy bank on top of their success. And so you go to their website, and there's one of two links you'll see. There's 5,000 different funds that you can buy through Fidelity, even though they sell, some 450 or so of their own. They also sell 5,000 other companies. So, boy, I talk about a sip from the fire hose and too much information, too many choices. So you do that on your own. Great. Let's continue. Investor services, slide 63. One of the best things about mutual funds is the ability to invest with small amounts of money. The automatic investment plan makes it very easy and cheap for the mutual fund company to allow you to automatically send fixed amounts of money from your paycheck or from your bank account into the fund. $50 a month, $100 a month. You see, the mutual fund companies don't want you to send them a check every month for $50 a month. It costs them $5, $10 just to handle the check. So they want you to electronically do it. And if it goes through your paycheck or your bank account, great. They love you. And it's called dollar cost averaging, which is a really bad name for a phenomenal way to invest. And we'll discuss this later, and we'll come back to it again later in the semester. And if you're taking the 121 class, or if you've already taken the 121 class, pay yourself first should be something that sounds very familiar to you, right? Exactly. In my humble opinion, this is the absolute bestest way to invest in a mutual fund. Why? Because you do not have to worry about whether or not is it a good time to invest. Is the market going to go up? Is the market going to go down? I don't know. Well, it doesn't matter. Every month is a good time to invest $50 a month that comes right out of your paycheck or your checking account or whatever you can afford. And postscript, P.S., it is practically the only way that most people will ever invest. You'll hear some people say, I'll wait until I get $5,000 or $10,000 and I'll start. When are you going to have an extra $5,000 or $10,000 laying around the house, huh? If you do, call me. Let's talk. Anyway, no, this is the way I started a million years ago, and this is the way most everybody of us humble individuals will start. And when you start a mutual fund, the default, they don't even ask you anymore. They automatically will set you up for a reinvestment plan. This is the service on slide 64 that enables shareholders to automatically buy additional shares in the fund through the reinvestment of dividends, interest, and capital gains. Automatic reinvestment plans allow an investor to earn fully compounded rates of return. Unless the investor needs the income, it's always a good idea to reinvest your dividends and your capital gains received from the mutual fund. Now, if you don't quite understand what I'm saying, don't worry about it, all right? Because what's going to happen is you're going to be buying shares of the mutual fund. And this gets people unnerved. They don't really quite understand their statements, and they kind of understand I'm putting money in, but what's going on? Well, you're buying shares. And then as the companies pay dividends, or if they're bonds, they pay interest, and if they're sold at a capital gain, the securities, the mutual fund company has to pass through those gains to the shareholders, and then the shareholders get taxed on it, unless it's in a retirement account, then it's deferred. So how they do that is by buying more shares for you. They create more shares for you. And automatically those shares are reinvested back into your plan. Now you can tell them don't do that. have the money sent to me. I'm living off of that money. But most people, when you're in the accumulation phase, when you're working and sending the kids to school and you're living your life, and you're building your retirement account or other account, and you want those shares reinvested. Make sense? Okay, if not, you know, contact me. We'll talk. Slide 64. How are you going to take the money out? Well, it depends on why you put it in there. But let's say you put it in there for retirement, and you've built up a good little nest egg. How are you going to take it out? You're going to take it out all in one shot? No, you're going to have it systematically withdrawn from the plan. And these services enable shareholders to automatically receive a predetermined amount of money every month or quarter or semi-annually or annually. And what they do is they electronically deposit the money in your checking account. Very cool. So here's the deal. You're going to put $100, $50 a month for 30 years into this mutual fund, 40 years, and then you're going to take $2,000 or $3,000 out a month for the rest of your life. How's that for a deal? I hope you like that idea. I like that idea. And then, as we said, oh, no, we haven't said this yet, conversion privilege. This, oh, yeah, we said something along these lines. In a fund family, it's called the exchange privilege, the conversion privilege. This allows shareholders to move money from one fund to another fund within the fund family without having to pay those commissions that we talked about if you have a commission a front-end load or a back-end load. Careful, you may trigger tax consequences, but that's shouldn't be the main decision why you move it or not. The decision should be based on whether it makes sense for you to move it. You need to be more conservative, or you've been too conservative, it's time to be more aggressive. But if it's in a retirement account, you don't care. Slide number 66, transactions. Well, we've already gone through this. Let's solidify, make sure we understand this. When you want to buy your mutual fund, how do you do it? Well, if it's a closed-end mutual fund or an ETF, you have to buy it through the stock exchange. You go through your broker. But as we said, some mutual fund companies have created their own brokerage companies, so you can go directly through them and not pay a commission if you buy their mutual funds. The open-end mutual funds you can buy through a broker, directly from the investment company, and as we said, the bestest way is to automatically contribute through your payroll, 401k, checking account, IRA, Roth IRA, regular account. When you go to sell the mutual fund, when you go to take your money out, the closed-end, the ETFs have to go through a brokerage firm, through the stock exchange, whereas the open-end, you call up your broker, or you call up the mutual fund, or go online, and in my humble opinion, the best way is automatic withdrawals. Okay, slide 67, taxes. Oh, come on, Payana, why are you always bringing up taxes? Well, it's important. We need to understand how taxes affect our investments. As we said, they shouldn't be the tail that wags the dog. They shouldn't be the most important part of why we invest or what we invest in, but they should be something we think about. And there are two types of taxes for regular accounts. There's the income dividends, which are taxed as dividends. However, if they're qualified dividends, and I don't want to get too much into this because it gets into the tax code, they give you a big tax break. And then capital gains distributions, which are taxed as capital gains, providing they're long-term over a year. And they give you a big tax break for them, too. The reinvested dividends and the reinvested capital gains are still taxable transactions. Even though you didn't take the money in cash, you took it in additional shares, you have to pay taxes on that. Save your year-end statements, folks. Hang on to those and save your all your tax stuff till we talked about that more in the 121 class. And what happens is people get this 1099 from their in mutual fund company. And they say, hey, you know, you have to pay taxes on $1,000 worth of capital gains and distributions and dividends. And the person says, well, I didn't get that money. Well, yes, you did. You got more shares. Worse is you might have gotten them in a year when your mutual fund actually went down. How's that for a kick in the teeth? And people get, hey, they jump up and down and get angry, and they don't really understand how it's working. And so they go to their congressperson and say, what's going on here? And so the congresspeople kind of go, oh, all right, what do you want us to do about it? And there's always talk of not taxing the unrealized capital gains. But it ain't going to happen, folks. I don't think that they're ever going to change the rules. It would just make it too much of a nightmare to keep track of all the reinvested dividends and capital gains that you reinvested but didn't take the money out in cash and then have to pay taxes on them later on. I just don't think that the Congress is ever going to go for it, because their advisors are saying, you know, you really want to make things messy, go ahead and do that. So let's not hold our breath. You're going to someday get a 1099 to pay. If it's a regular account, if it's a retirement account, this doesn't matter, right? But if you have a regular account, you're going to get a 1099 someday, and even though the mutual fund lost money, you're going to have to pay taxes on gains that you didn't even see because they were reinvested back into the mutual fund. And you might get angry, but just realize that, hey, that's the way the game is played. Now, as we said, if it's in a retirement account or an educational savings account or a health savings account, what the IRS calls tax qualified, then you pay no taxes until retirement. And then, depending on what type of account it is, you might not pay any income taxes. If it's a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k or a health savings account, you might not pay any taxes, which is a very cool deal. Okay, slide number 68. Where do we get our information? Well, most people don't bother. They just, I don't know, maybe their friends tell them, hey, I like this company, or they saw this advertisement on television, but that's not you. You're going to get in there and read that prospectus. It's the statement that describes the risk factors, the fund's past performance, the type of investments, information about dividends, distributions, and taxes, information about the fund's management, and nobody reads them. Nobody reads them. In fact, they've sort of given up. They've now, it used to be about 32 pages or so, and now they're 5 pages. They've gotten them really, what are called summaries prospectuses, because this SEC realized they were just destroying a bunch of trees. And now many companies just say, oh, go on our website and click that little box there, and that's good enough. Of course, if you've taken Business 123, you're going to read it. And I pass it around in the face-to-face class, and online on the class website are links for you to follow. And we want you to take a look at some of these prospectuses and read them. And realize why nobody reads them. They're really, really useful if you have insomnia. Exactly. If you need to, you can't sleep at night, read a prospectus. I assure you, you will be fast asleep very quickly. Now, what is the document you will read? And that's the Mutual Fund Annual Report. That's one of your assignments. One of your assignments for Chapter 4 is to find a Mutual Fund Annual Report. If you want a hard copy, if you want one in your hot little hands, call me, contact me, I have some extras, or just contact the mutual fund company you're interested in. They'll first ask whether they can send it to you electronically, because, of course, it's cheaper for them and it saves trees. Or if you don't mind reading stuff electronically, go on the class website and you'll see links to where they have the prospectuses and the annual reports for the 6 or so companies that I've put on there. I think it's 6 or 7, I don't remember. But check it out. And you're going to be searching through that mutual fund annual report for certain things. But I want you to read it first. And there's a commentary about the assignment. You do that. Okay, slide number 69, mutual fund financial publications. Well, as we said, I think I mentioned, there are two major companies, Lipper's the old school, Morningstar is the new school, both of which you can get for free at the library. You've been to a library, haven't you? It's a really interesting place. They have lots of books, but that's not all they have. And most libraries have Morningstar or Lipper or both. Business Week, Forbes, Kiplinger's, Money Magazine, these are all sources of information on mutual funds. One of the most well-respected is the U.S. News and World Report, right? They have an annual issue devoted to mutual funds. The surveys include the fund's rating compared to funds in the same category, the size, the sales history, sales charge, expense ratio, risk of loss, toll-free numbers, and the history for the past 3, 5, and 10 years. I submit to you that 10 years is the shortest amount of time you should look at. I like to look at 20, 30, 50 years worth of returns, but that's me. Other people want to look at, I want to see the ones that have done the best in the last 1, 2, or 3, or 5 years. So that's up to you. I like to see long-term results. And then there are several financial websites, Business Week, Morningstar, Finance. I will talk about finance.yahoo.com in more detail. They've really destroyed that website. What a great website. And they just obliterated it. It's as if somebody with ADHD has taken over and made it impossible to actually focus on anything. And then the mutual fund companies. When the internet became, you know, very big hot phenomenon in the late 1990s, they really, you know, dumped a lot of money into these things, especially Vanguard and T. Rowe Price. What a great, Vanguard's website, they had this Investing University. It was actually pretty darn, it was a must stop for me. And then in the bear market of 2000 to 2002, they all got quiet. I don't know if the Securities and Exchange Commission told them to calm it down. I don't know what happened, but a lot of them just basically shut down. And I mean, they had a few little things here and there. But now they're promoting education again. They have commentaries about the year behind, the year ahead. And I have links to those. Some of the best ones, I think, are T. Rowe Price, American Funds, and Dodge & Cox. Dodge & Cox, well, they're not actually that small, but they only have 5 funds. They're kind of strange. But these people are just real down to earth, very, very mild-mannered. They look like something out of a Rockwell painting, Norman Rockwell painting. But, boy, they're sharp. They've got some good results. And then, as we said, the mother load of data is from the Investment Company Institute, but now they're asking you to pony up $600 to get the good stuff. No, we'll see. Their annual fact book, which comes out around May or so, we'll see if they still allow it to be downloaded for free. We'll see. Slide 71. Whew! Are you exhausted yet? I don't know. Well, this presentation is not as hairy as the second or the third one. Where was it? But still, it's just a daunting experience when you look at all the different options. And what people will come back and say, well, how do I pick one? It's not an easy task. In fact, in the face-to-face class, before we get to here, I have already shown them the 400 and some odd Fidelity funds and the 170 Vanguard funds and the 38 American funds. And I try to give them that feeling of, what do I do? Because that's what you're up against. You're not alone. That's what everybody is up against when it comes to picking a mutual fund. So here's some advice from yours truly. Slide 71. Pick a mutual fund that invests in high quality stocks or bonds. There's that term, quality. Now, you know, one person's quality is another person's garbage, so that's ambiguous, isn't it? But, as we'll see when we get to chapters 5 and 6, there are certain distinctions, there are certain characteristics that we see from high quality companies that you can know it when you see it. Now, we can argue at the margins, but yeah, that's a high-quality company, right? But that doesn't mean it won't go down. It doesn't mean it's going to go up. Is well-diversified, diversification across several industries and sectors of the economy. has a long-term perspective, and I mean long-term. I like 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And a manager, or better yet, a management team with many years of experience. What I suggest you do is avoid companies that shuffle their managers every few years, which used to be virtually all of them. Many of the companies would just, like a deck of cards, shuffle up their managers. Fidelity was famous for this. If you did well there, boom, you got to be showered with attention and money, and you got to stay. If you didn't do well, well, you know, sorry. It's been 2 years, and you're way behind the pack. You need to go. But now the mutual fund companies are realizing it's not the best way to get good results over the long term, because it encourages mutual fund managers just starting out to take large risks, because they know, they're not stupid, they know that if they do well, they're going to get to stick around, they're going to get rewarded financially. And so they might as well take big risks. If things turn out, great, and if things don't turn out so well, well, they wouldn't have been around there anyway. The companies are realizing this was a bad incentive, not a good way. So they're treating their managers with much more long term. Not all. And I like to look for funds that have been around for decades and performed consistently well in both good and bad markets. Don't tell me how well you've done in a good market. I ain't interested. Everybody does well in a good market. You know, even me. I want to know how well you did when the organic matter hit the ventilating device. Because it will. It's not a matter of whether it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. History tells us we're going to have good markets and we're going to have bad markets. And it's how well your mutual fund does in those bad markets that will, to a great extent, determine your long-term success, and obviously theirs and yours, long-term success. So, on slide 72, we would now, in the face-to-face class, hand out some brochures and the like about a sample, just one, stock mutual fund company. And this one's been around for 80 years. Is that long-term enough, folks? And how's it done? 8, 9, 10%? No, it's done 12%. Now, remember, when we talk to people about stocks, we tell them, oh, 8 to 10%. But we find that there are stock mutual funds and stocks that have done better than 10, 11, 12%. And then there are some things that we'll go through the online. Are stocks risky in the short term and the long term? Now's not a good time to invest. So, excuse me, when is ever a good time to invest? And those are on the website. I want you to take a look at them. So are stocks risky in the short term? Yeah, they are. But in the long term? No, they aren't. Providing the world doesn't end, in which case it doesn't matter. When is it a good time to invest? It's never a good time to invest. There's always people worried. There's always worries. There are always problems on the horizon. But this one instrument shows what had happened if you had invested on the worst day and what would have happened if you invested on the best day. And it turns out that they're not that different. I mean, obviously they're different, but not that different if you have a long-term perspective. And then what about the times when the market goes down because it's going to go down? No problem. You keep a long-term perspective. You realize you're in it for 5, 10, 15 years or more, depending on your individual situation, and dollar cost average. There's that funny term again. Slide 73. What does it mean? Well, here's the definition, and you're going to forget it, but I hope you don't. A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. Huh? Well, it's easier to understand than it is to understand how it works than it is to understand this definition. $50 a month, $100 a month. Can you afford that? And people say, oh, I don't know. And then I say, okay, what's your cell phone payment? Oh, well, it's $90, but it's supposed to be $70 or $60, but I downloaded a lot of ringtones or whatever. What's your cable bill, you know? Can you put $50 a month? Oh, I guess I can. Okay, great. You're young. Get started now. And the cool thing about dollar cost averaging, folks, and this is a very cool thing, is that there's always good news. I tell my wife, I say, Anita, I haven't done this in a while because she's given up on me, but I say, Anita, because that's her name. Anita, no matter what happens tomorrow, when we wake up, there's good news. And she rolls her eyes and says, sure, thank you. The market's up. Good news. Well, your account is worth more, right? That's what you expected it to happen. And yeah, it's going up. The market's down. Good news. What? How could the market be down? Good news. Well, think about it. Next month, you will get more shares at a lower price when those $50 or $100 come out of your paycheck or your checking account. And it is those market downturns that determine our long-term success. Are you going to run and hide at the worst possible time when the market goes down and then wait for it to go back up and then put your money back in? I mean, investments are one of the few places that people do that. If there's a discount at the store, people run in the doors, right? Not at the stock market. No, they run out the doors. And why? Well, we'll discuss that later on in detail when we get to stock investing and stocks. We're not rational beings. As much as we'd like to think we are, we're not rational. And the very cool thing about dollar cost averaging, and I want you to memorize it even though you probably forget, is that your average cost per share should be lower, should be less than your average price per share. It is not a guarantee. It is not a guarantee. But you're going to be buying fewer shares when the prices are high and more shares when the prices are low. It's not a guarantee, but it often works out that way. And we'll come back to this after we've gone through stocks, after we've gone through bonds, and after when we're looking backwards at our education of stocks and bonds. All right? We'll come back to this. Relax. I want you to memorize it, but if you don't worry about it. But try to tell people, oh, yeah, I dollar cost average because my average cost per share should be lower than my average price per share. And they'll go, huh? What? Yeah, later. Slide 74, hypotheticals. Most mutual fund companies have a system for running what are called hypotheticals, hypothetical illustrations. They are examples of returns of investments for either lump sum and principals, lump sum payments, or series of investments, or streams of investments, which is what dollar cost averaging is, or a combination of both. They must be approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission and FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and contain disclaimers about past versus future performance, because these are results from the past. Are they guarantees about what's going to happen in the future? You know the answer. Of course they are not guarantees of what's going to happen in the future. They're showing you what's happened in the past. But, you know, unless the world falls apart or for some reason capitalism becomes blasé, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon, but, you know, if something better comes along, we'll run it up the flagpole, see how it works, see if anybody salutes. But, no, I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, I teach this stuff. I'm a broker, you know, I'm invested. So, on the website, again, in the face-to-face class, we would now run these hypotheticals. But on the class website are some hypotheticals, and you can run through these. Examples of $100 a month for 30 years. Examples of $100 for 40 years. Or, if you don't have as much time, an example of $500 a month for 20 years. Ugh, see, this is the problem. You get the baby boomers come up and say, why didn't you tell me this 25 years ago? Sorry. And so if you want me to run another hypothetical, just, you know, contact me, and I'll run one and throw it up on the website. And this is the cool thing about the face-to-face class. I can do it there, right there in front of the students, kind of like Julia Child. Okay? So do that. Make sure you've run those hypotheticals. And that's for that sample mutual fund that we are taking a look. Just one mutual fund, right? It's not all mutual funds, but the cool thing about the mutual fund industry is that there are many examples, and you're looking at them right now on slide 75. You're looking at these many examples of companies that have done well over 50 years. Each and every one of these mutual funds on slide 75 has been around for 50 years or longer. Some of them 70 or 80 years. Look at that Dodge and Cox Balance Fund, 1931. The Fidelity Fund, 1930. Right. And, you know, it's not a guarantee for the future. But it's a pretty darn good track record, isn't it? It sure is. And these are just ones that have been around for 50 years or more. There are others that have been around, you know, 20, 30, 40 years and have done just as well, if not better. Look at that T. Rowe Price Fund. Whoop, whoop, whoop. 13%, folks. Wow. Now, you might have done the exercises in Chapter 1 for future value. You might not have. But if you are at all interested, go back and do them and see that, yes, there are places where you can get 10% or more for over 50 years. Cool? All right. So we showed you a sample mutual fund, and there'll be some things you're going to go through on the website to show you how that mutual fund is done. Realize that that isn't the only one out there. There are many other mutual funds that have done very well over the long term. All right. What's the bottom line on mutual funds? Line 76. What I want you to do is do your research, and my recommendation is to choose a fund family and stick with them. Why? There's a saying in the industry that has already been shown statistically to be true, that most mutual fund investors do worse than the mutual funds they invest in. Wait a minute, Piano. How can that be? How can a mutual fund investor do worse than the mutual fund they invest in? Well, when you think about it, it's actually very simple. They wait until the mutual fund does really, really well and makes it into the news and gets a 5-star rating from Morningstar, and then they jump in, only to find that the next year they don't do as well for whatever reason. You know, maybe they took large bets. Maybe the type of stock that they are good at picking is that whole industry is just not as in vogue anymore. It's not having its day in the sun, so to speak, anymore. And they then jump out after they've lost 30-40% and go find another mutual fund that has had its day in the sun. And so what do? They buy high and they sell low. In fact, it's a cliche now in the industry. What many people in the industry do now is look at the mutual fund inflows and outflows. And I don't have a graphic for it. I need to find a good one. But they literally will find times when people have stuck a ton of money into the mutual funds. And that's the time they believe that the market's going to fall. Because that's what's happened in the past. Again, it's not a guarantee. And they find times when people have pulled out a whole bunch of money out of their mutual funds, and that's the time the market's going to rise. It's like clockwork. So, you don't be one of them. Don't be one of the mutual fund investors that does worse than your mutual fund. Reevaluate them periodically. Once or twice a year is usually good enough, but make changes judiciously and sparingly. As you approach retirement, you want to migrate from stock funds to bond funds, but don't give up on stocks entirely, folks. We'll discuss this in more detail later on. Even in retirement, you still need some growth. Why? Because people are living far longer. And dollar cost average. $50 a month, $100 a month, whatever you can afford, forget about them. Just forget about them. And the best investors, I love when I help people, I'll talk to them after a market downturn and I'll say, how are you doing? You know, it's been a couple years now. How things going for you? Oh, it's great. Now, the market dropped. How did you feel? Oh, I didn't even look at my statement. I was like, great. That's it. That's what we want. We want somebody who doesn't even look at their statements. We're going to put you in a more aggressive fund. If it's somebody who I call and they go, oh, I just lost $200. Or I lost $50. I say, all right, okay. We need to put you in a more a conservative fund. But please, don't look at it more than, you know, 6, 3, 6, 9 months or so, because you drive yourself crazy. Make sense? I hope it does. I hope it does. Mutual funds are long-term investments. Do your research. Find a family that has done well over the long term and stick with them. Slide number 77. We are finished with mutual funds. Very, very important, because chances are you're going to have these as your options in your 401k or other employer-sponsored plan, or maybe a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. And now, dear students, and mutual funds are kind of boring, aren't they? Well, they're kind of confusing at the same time, but they're kind of boring. Now you're ready, because in our next chapter, we're going to tackle the stock market and stocks. Exciting stocks, sexy stocks, risky stocks. See you in Chapter 5.